Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm swell.
I'm happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, we are looking at the most pressing issue in the world of entertainment, and maybe the world in general. I don't know. No, we're not talking about the genocide Olympics in Beijing or the potential invasion of Ukraine by Russia. We're not talking about soaring OD rates or the out of control truckers in the 51st state up north. I speak, of course, of the fact that the terrible, no good, very bad Cinderella remake that debuted on Amazon to much booing and jeering looks like it might win the Oscars idiotic new best popular most watched
voted on
Twitter movie, whatever that new dumb category is. That's right, the drag queen fairy godmother movie featuring the nation's most annoying late night talk show host as a talking mouse is supposedly leading the early voting on Twitter, according to Deadline and elsewhere. This is what the Academy gets for leaving off Zack Snyder's Justice League, making it ineligible for inclusion. How dare they? And there are all sorts of, like, kind of semi-trolling campaigns underway. Fans of Johnny Depp are pushing for his long-delayed Minamata to win the award. This would be a payback for the establishment getting rid of him from Hollywood's polite society after, you know, all the accusations of domestic abuse. Meanwhile, the
Sonny,
actual...
Johnny, you buried the lead there. There are still fans of Johnny Depp?
Many fans of Johnny Depp. You don't want to undersell his ability to draw
the
weirdos on
Depp
Twitter.
Hive.
Meanwhile, the actual most popular theatrical film of the year, Spider-Man No Way Home, is not doing as well as the Oscars would have hoped. And this is what always happens every time they monkey with the rules. Remember what happened after they introduced the 10 category limit following The Dark Knight getting shut out. It was just a lot of still very low budgeted films getting nominated. This is, of course, the nature of the internet, where Bodie McBoatface can win an internet poll designed to let voters name a new boat for the British National Environment Research Council. To quote a wise newsman, I've said it before and I'll say it again, democracy simply does not work. It's easy to blame this on the internet, though. The internet is terrible. Everybody hates the internet. The internet wants to reward the bad Cinderella movies and the bad Johnny Depp movies. But the real problem here is that the Academy is trying to offload the work of selecting a movie that appeals simultaneously to both, for lack of better terms, the snobs and the slobs out there. They are desperate to recapture an audience that is gone and probably never coming back. But they're also desperate not to dilute the brand of the Oscars, the brand that stands for excellence and exclusivity via the awards presented to all-time classics like Green Book and Shakespeare in Love and Crash, not the good one directed by David Cronenberg about sex and car crashes, but the bad one about racism directed by Paul Haggis. Peter, who is to really blame for this Bodie McBoatfacing of the most popular Oscar race?
So I guess what this makes me think of, since I know this is a movies podcast, but we all write about politics. We all work for publications that deal a lot in politics. And what this really makes me think about is the current debates about the Democratic Party and popularism. So this is different from populism, if you don't know the term. This comes from folks like Democratic pollster analyst David Shore. Matt Iglesias has occasionally sort of trafficked in this sort of thing. And popularism stems from an argument that the Democratic Party elite, elected officials in particular, have become too enthralled to a very narrow base, and in particular to a professional activist class, to insiders who do Democratic politics for a living and are much to the left of the average, not just of the average American, but to the average Democratic voter. And so their argument is, you know what Democrats should do to win elections? They should do popular stuff. And then they should win elections and maybe also do some other stuff that progressives like, but they have to do popular stuff and promise to do popular stuff. And that's how you win elections. And I feel like the Oscars are now in a similar position where they sort of realize that what the Oscars voters, what the Academy wants to do is not reward and award films that are popular with people who go see movies, with people who go see movies occasionally. Instead, what they want to do is give awards to a particular type of film that appeals to the voting, like to Oscar voters and to professionals, to insiders. And so they're trying to wrestle with this. And and their solutions to this problem are all super awkward because they can't just take responsibility and do the thing that they kind of feel like they need to do, which is just give Spider-Man the freaking Oscar. And
or
also
at least a
don't want to do because their members are like, we shouldn't give Spider-Man the Oscar. And I understand this, right? Spider-Man, I don't think I don't think that the new Spider-Man film is necessarily like a best picture winner type of movie. At the same time, they both want to have that big popular audience and not actually just commit to being like, well, what we do is we serve the moviegoers who pay our salaries. What they want to do is present an image to the world that is an image that satisfies Democratic voters, Democratic insiders in some ways, right? Because the Academy is like leans quite to the left. What they want to do is present an image to the world that pleases themselves and pleases other Academy voters. It's an image that's like we reward small films, that are sort of have a particular type of craft, often have a social message attached to them, that sort of thing. And that's if that's what they want to do, that's fine. I even like some of those movies. I often like them better than the Spider-Man type films. I have sympathies with Oscar insiders here in many, many ways. At the same time, it's a problem if you also want to put on an award ceremony that is like attracts normal people who are not like going out, rushing out to art house theaters to see Moonlight and Nomadland.
Yeah, Alyssa, I mean, I think the problem here is that the Academy has kind of a self-image problem. They don't know exactly what they want to be. They want to be both a arbiter of quality and also immensely entertaining to the vast majority of people. And those, I mean, I guess Hollywood's always kind of been like that, but it feels like the distinction between those two things has grown more pronounced in recent years.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's the business problem that the industry faces as well, right? I mean, everyone says that they want to be in the business of making fine art, unless you're, you know, Disney, in which case you're in the business of just printing money. But what supports the entire business case of the industry at this point is a couple of billion-dollar tentpoles each year. And you know, there is just a sort of industry-wide schizophrenia about what it is that the movies do and what the Oscars do. And I think that's really difficult to overcome. Certainly one solution to this would be if Marvel was willing, for example, to let those movies get a little bit weirder and more experimental and more interesting. And I think to a certain extent, you know, Chloe Zhao's Helming of the Eternals was supposed to sort of nod in that direction, and it did not work at all, which probably means that they won't try again. But clearly, blockbusters like Black Panther and Joker can get nominated for Academy Awards. There is space in that genre and in other popular genres to do stuff that is sophisticated and that looks good. And, you know, if more of those gazillion-dollar movies were attempting to be a little bit more interesting, then you probably would have a little bit more overlap in that Venn diagram. But it's tough. I mean, you can't sort of elevate work that nobody has seen and also put on an award show that 50 million people watch. You just can't do it. And the inability of anyone involved to sort of find a way to do both. And, you know, I didn't think the best popular Oscar category was a terrible idea, right? I mean, you know, set a cutoff wherever you want, the top 25 grossing movies a year, top 50, set that eligibility pool, and acknowledge that there is really quality work being done in those movies. I mean, that could actually be a way to get people interested in the craft. I could see an award for like a best second unit. I think there are ways to simultaneously honor and maybe even educate people about the craft that goes into these ginormous movies, and honor some of them without sacrificing the ability to call attention to some of these other movies. But the Academy just doesn't seem confident about doing that. And I think they end up making themselves look ridiculous sort of over and over again. And I can't understand why there isn't a more graceful way to bridge the gap that they've created.
Well, I think they're worried that they would end up becoming something that looks more like the old MTV Movie Awards. And that's not what they want to be. At the same time, they want to court the audience that watched the old, the same type of today's version of the audience that watched the old MTV Movie Awards. And somehow or another, they want to have that audience while giving Nomadland Best Picture. Again, I love Nomadland, just for anybody listening here. I thought it was an actually worthy Best Picture winner. At the same time, and I even think that it's a film that can appeal to a wide variety of moviegoers. At the same time, it is just a little seen film, small budget movie, and it's not going to be the kind of thing that is going to break box office records and really get people to turn out.
But then why not come up with a craft award that's basically a proxy for these popular movies, like best second unit, best stunt direction, you know, something that gets at a particular skill in the industry that the Academy doesn't recognize particularly well, that overlaps a lot with these big popular movies. And then, you know, just finds a way to pull them in while still having a lot of integrity about the work that goes into making those movies happen.
But nobody's going to tune into the Oscars to see who wins best stunt or best action choreography. I mean, that they already have best special effects, right? Spider-Man No Way Home is nominated in best special effects. Nobody is sitting there thinking well, this is I'm definitely watching so I can catch. Part of me thinks that this is not really a problem. I think that the Academy gets very reactionary when something that is very popular and is generally pretty well acclaimed doesn't get nominated. For instance, again, the last time this happened was with The Dark Knight. Dark Knight grosses tons and tons of money. It's a very critically acclaimed movie that you know, audiences and critics love, and grosses, you know, $1 billion worldwide, and doesn't get nominated for Best Picture. So the next year they expand it to 10 Best Picture nominations. And that kind of works for a couple of years until it doesn't anymore. And then it's, you know, it's just a bunch of smaller movies. But that said, I mean, look, as we mentioned, what, Joker grosses $1 billion. That gets nominated for Best Picture. Black Panther grosses $1.6 billion or whatever. That gets nominated for Best Picture. I take the basic position that if the Academy had nominated No Way Home, great, that's fine. Look at Black Panther, look at Joker. If it didn't feel like it makes the cut, well, I mean, neither did either of the last two Avengers movies, and those movies were hugely popular and did very well with critics and audiences. I feel like this is a not terribly significant problem that is driven by fear over ratings decline that is inevitable anyway.
So maybe a different way to think about this is just that this is a problem with superhero films, and the Academy doesn't quite know how to reckon with the fact that the business has now bifurcated into a very small number, it's quite small art house films that don't appeal to mass audiences, and superhero films, which along with, you know, sort of live action CG Disney remakes and a couple of other categories dominate the box office. What they actually want to award are films like Green Book, which was a popular hit, right? That was that movie made $300 and something million at the box office. But there just aren't movies like Green Book to award anymore. And so what they're not doing are making this third thing of movies that feel adult enough, but also make $150 million plus at the box office.
A better example of this is Gladiator or Braveheart. These are the sorts of big action movies for adults that also had pretensions of artistic, you know, worthiness, right?
And this year, The Last Duel.
Or this year would have been The Last Duel. Nobody went to go see The Last Duel. People don't go to see that sort of movie anymore. And it's a problem. It's a problem for the industry writ large, but it's especially a problem for the Oscars, which, you know, doesn't know how to square that circle.
But I think a lot of the problem for the Academy is the inability to sort of stay the course with something and say, you know, there will be years when one of these 10 is a very popular movie. It's just the constant flailing and casting about for a new solution when you have to just sort of have some confidence in order to build the integrity of the awards. I just think it's the image of insecurity is actually more problematic than the divide in what gets nominated and what doesn't.
Yeah. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that a bad movie is almost guaranteed to win this dumb new award? Alyssa?
It's a non-controversy. Something like that was inevitable.
Peter?
It's a controversy, I think, in the sense that it suggests it's indicative of the Academy's deep inability to understand its role in the world.
it's a non-controversy because, again, this is it's a bad new category and they should get rid of it and they should just not worry.
It's not even a category. It's a fan contest.
It's a popular vote. The popular vote is always bad.
We should probably need an
electoral college to come in here and say no.
Well, that's what the Academy is. We should probably clarify that it is you don't get an actual statue for winning this award. However, the award does get presented, I think, by 3 Twitter randos.
Yes.
At the Oscars. The randos.
In other words, the three of us will be at the Dolby Theater.
I still think that's the only way to redeem this category is to have the Across the Movie Aisle Presents terrible Twitter vote category. To Minamata. Congratulations, Johnny Depp. All right, a quick programming reminder. Rather than posting both episodes of Across the Movie Aisle on Tuesday, as we had been doing, we've decided to spread the love a bit. Main episode's going to go up on Tuesday, as usual, and they will be available simultaneously on Substack and your preferred podcast app, iTunes, whatever you use. And then the bonus episode, going to post on Fridays, and it will continue to only be available to members of Bulwark Plus. So go to atma.thebulwark.com. And sign up if you want to get that special members-only bonus episode. This week, we're talking about Steven Soderbergh's Kimmy, which is available on HBO Max now. Very excited to talk about that. I love this. Love this whole new Steven Soderbergh doing a random streaming movie like once every 6 months or so. It's a wonderful era. And now, on to the main event. Uncharted. Tom Holland, fresh off his $1.8 billion turn, as Peter Parker in No Way Home returned to the top of the box office this week with Sony's long-gestating cinematic adaptation of the series of video games one might describe as something like Indiana Jones, but with more parkour and pirate gold. Holland stars as Nathan Drake, an orphan who grows up to be a pickpocketing bartender before getting shanghaied into adventure by Sully, who is played by Mark Wahlberg. Sully's looking for Magellan's gold. I'm not going to explain this. Just trust me, Magellan, big pot of gold somewhere. As is Santiago Moncado, who is played by Antonio Banderas. And there are some femme fatales in there and a Scottish guy who nobody can understand. That's a very funny joke, Scottish guy. The whole thing is a pretty straightforward paint-by-numbers action picture that could have just as easily starred The Rock or Vin Diesel. It's generic. It's fine. You have your in media res action beat followed by a flashback to Nate's childhood, followed by his induction into the world of treasure hunting. And then there's the treasure hunt itself. You go from the streets of Barcelona to the tunnels of Barcelona, to the jungles of the Philippines, culminating in a big action set piece with flying pirate ships. Don't worry. That last bit makes tons of sense in context. Tom Holland has pulled a bit of a Leonardo DiCaprio here. And by that, I mean this. Do you remember what the first film to dethrone Titanic at the box office was? It was The Man in the Iron Mask, starring one Leo. Granted, it's not exactly one-to-one. No Way Home hasn't been number one this entire time. Scream and Jackass have kind of hopped in there, take down a few scores. But Uncharted is the first genuine hit in the post-No Way Home landscape. It's going to gross about $51 million. We're taping this on Monday, so we're doing some approximates here. But over the four-day weekend, it'll gross about $51 million. And No Way Home is still the third highest grossing film in the nation this past weekend. It's the age of Tom Holland, right? Two questions here. One, is he the new Leo? I'm skeptical. I mean, maybe he is. I don't know. But nothing else in his body of work suggests that's the case. You've got Chaos Walking, which was an almost legendary bomb. No one has seen Cherry because it's on Apple TV Plus, but the reviews were not kind.
I've seen it, and the reviews were, in fact, too kind.
The Devil All the Time was kind of interesting. He was starring with Robert Pattinson, another fellow kind of heartthrob type actor. But I don't think it moved the needle that much. And I don't think we should entirely count out Mark Wahlberg as a box office attraction here, given his, you know, track record of success, though that has been spotty recently as well. Here's the second question. Are we entering a new era of video game franchise feature films? I mean, we've pretty relentlessly fracked the comic book IPs. So we gotta turn our attention to the rich fields of video game deposits to be exploited. The track record here is spotty. For every original Resident Evil film, right, which was fine, there are like 17 sequels to that, which suck and are terrible, except maybe the third one, set in Vegas. I like that one. It was okay. For every Silent Hill, which is competently moody, I kind of like that one. There's Alone in the Dark, which isn't. For every Uncharted, there are two Angelina Jolie Tomb Raiders. I could go on, but my point is this, that ever since Super Mario Brothers and Double Dragon bombed very, very hard in the early 90s, video games have essentially served as fodder for terrible movies. Alyssa, Here is my opening question to you. Does Uncharted's, let's say, averageness make it one of the best video game movies of all time?
Or am I overstating?
Am I overstating its even marginal appeal by grading on such a steep curve?
I have to say that Uncharted sort of entered through my eyeballs and immediately exited my memory. Like, I'm sort of having trouble recalling the details of it, even sitting here. So it was inoffensive. Maybe that's the best way to put it. And I do think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens with the upcoming Halo TV series and BioShock movie. So I will be curious to see if a legitimately golden age of video games is actually upon us. I found this interesting to watch as someone who does not play video games, in part because it raised a question for me about the role of plausibility in movies and video games, respectively. Because this is not a movie where there are superheroes or people with special powers or even the sort of in-world established rule that ridiculous things are possible, as is the case with the Fast and Furious movies. And yet it features things like Tom Holland, you know, climbing up a bunch of cargo that's falling out of the back of an airplane and doing things that are just not even remotely plausibly survivable, much less possible. You know, that the sequence at the end with a bunch of flying pirate ships, like, that's just not a thing. That's not a thing that can happen. Those boats would fall apart. The Philippines were very damp. Like, those ships would be rotted and they would fall apart the minute they were lifted up in the air. And that seems to be a thing that is sort of fine in a video game context, right? At least that is my impression. But it just felt all so silly watching it on screen, right? There was nothing that brought me into the world and convinced me that the things that I was seeing on screen made any sense or had any level of plausibility. Whereas it seems like that would be okay in a video game context. Am I wrong about that? I'm just sort of wondering about the role of plausibility in the two different media.
I think that's relatively fair. I mean, I would say that I don't know if those specific sequences exactly have happened in the Uncharted games. I played, I think, either two or three of them. And so I
can tell, like, you that the cargo ship sequence is pulled directly from the video games.
Yeah.
Now it occurs somewhat differently in the games, right? It's not a shot for shot remake, but it's heavily based on a sequence in which essentially the same thing happens.
Yeah, that felt familiar. I mean, the pirate ships, again, that's a little more extravagant, I think. But it reminds me of, this is why I mentioned The Rock,
yeah,
is because it really feels like a Rampage or a Skyscraper or something like that. Like, kind of big budget, generic action movie.
Yeah. I think the strongest impression I was just left with was the sense of how much does plausibility
matter. And Rampage was based on a video game.
Technically
remember,
based on a video game.
An old, a very old, like a arcade era video game, like 2D thing where you played as a monster climbing up, trying to destroy buildings and eat people out of them. It's actually kind of great. I played a lot of it when I was 6 years old.
Yeah. But I do just wonder about the role of plausibility in each of these media and whether that creates sort of a translation problem, right? I mean, something like Steven Spielberg's adaptation of Ready Player One or even Free Guy, you know, sort of toggles you back and forth between what is, you know, reasonable and possible in the real world and a setting where the rules obviously are different and don't apply. And I wonder if trying to translate video game action sort of one-to-one to the movies creates something that feels a little bit, a vibe that feels a little bit off in a way that is cinematically difficult.
So I think that's a great question. And as a video gamer, I did not approach it that way because to me, it was pretty clear why these implausible things were happening. And it was that's more or less how they happen in video games. And this movie felt the need to check off a whole bunch of sort of this happens in video games boxes without connecting them very well or explaining them to newbies. I don't think the movie is unapproachable to newbies in the sense that it's like, it's not a movie that simply doesn't make sense. Like if you have seen Duncan Jones's Warcraft film, is just so filled with references to Warcraft, a game I've barely played, that I only barely understood a bunch of this stuff. And I had to have friends translate, like, why there was a sheep or a goat magic thing happening here. And like what all these like powers things were and what the orcs wanted. And like, I won't say that I found the movie baffling, but there was a lot of it that just, I didn't catch because I wasn't a Warcraft player. I don't think this movie has quite that problem. But the physics thing is different in video games because the way you determine video game physics is by pressing buttons and figuring out what you can do. And so in the Uncharted games, Nathan Drake can swing and run and jump in a way that is super heroic, that doesn't actually correspond to reality, but it has a certain internal logic, and that internal logic is this works if you get the timing on the buttons right, and it looks really cool and it feels neat right as it happens, in the same way that in a lot of video games both player characters and enemies are what are often called bullet sponges, right? So you have these, you will have a boss who is just a human in the game's fictional world. But because this character is a boss, even if they're not necessarily wearing a bunch of armor, you've got to shoot them 50 times. They don't see, like, they might take damage, as in their damage meter goes down, but they don't seem to actually get slower as you shoot them. They're just bullet sponges. And that's a trope that happens a lot in video games that gamers just accept because some amount of playability and sort of gaming is usually part of it, right? Some amount of player interaction is part of this, and a lot of it is just shooting stuff. But what I actually felt was so bothersome to me about this movie was that it didn't translate the natural appeal of these video games, because these video games are clever and witty, not just in the dialogue and the story, but in the way their action scenes are designed, and they're suspenseful. And in particular, they rely a lot on having to figure things out yourself, and also on stealth stuff. So there's the company that makes the Uncharted games, along with the Last of Us games, relies a lot on stealth mechanisms. Where it's less so in Uncharted and more so in the Last of Us games, but a stealth mechanism where, if you can imagine a version of the pirate ship sequence here, in the video games, you would have had Sully and Nathan Drake hiding in the cabin and have to sort of work their way slowly across the pirate ship without anybody seeing them, because if all the bad guys saw them, then all the henchmen would suddenly be alerted and you'd be fighting 50 of them rather than trying to quietly take out one at a time. And it's a really interesting mechanism just for, like, keeping the tension up. And there was none of that in this game, which just sort of felt like, well, we got to get to an action scene now. He's going to do some flip kicks and shoot some people. And it's got to be big, so we'll have the boats, you know, being carted around on helicopters. Okay, that's done, right? It was just an exercise in timid box checking, making sure that all the stuff that the fans absolutely had to have was in the movie, but not making it make any sort of dramatic or narrative sense. There's not a through line that makes you care at all. The movie assumes that you care already because it is made essentially for the millions of people who buy Uncharted games and already have some connection to these characters. But even as somebody who has played at least a little bit of number one and then most of 2, 3, and 4, I just found myself totally disconnected from the action and the characters because there's nothing there. It's just so pro forma.
Yeah, I mean, that's, again, this feels like a generically competent action movie. And I do think it is competent in the sense that it isn't a horrible mess. I could follow what was happening in the story. I was never.
Your standards are so low, Sonny.
No, but I don't expect much from a movie like this because there's nothing to expect from a movie like this. Like, I'm not going there expecting to be, you know, moved to tears by the adventures of, you know, Nathan Drake. Why would I get emotionally invested?
So I would actually say that one of the best pieces of big budget popular culture that I engaged with during 2020, when the world was really sort of strange and shut down, and I wasn't going to the movies basically for after the beginning of March, was a game called The Last of Us 2, which is produced by the same studio as the Uncharted games, has many of the same gameplay mechanisms. And that game, in that video game, I was tremendously moved. And it is a tough, difficult game that deals with thematic stuff that is inherent to games and gameplay. A problem that like video game critics have coined a term called ludonarrative. Basically, you like in the video games, in the Uncharted games in particular, you've got this quite appealing, like, you know, upstanding kind of Han Solo-ish sort of Joker hero who also just in every mission, he shoots like 50 people in the face because that's what you have to do to get through the missions. And like the game is just sort of like, well, but he's like basically a good guy who just constantly shooting people in the face, that you are making him shoot people in the face. And so in Last of Us 2, they actually kind of deal with this by making the violence the subject of the game and making it about a character who is like a person who has just been deeply broken by the apocalyptic and traumatic state of the world. And so playing that game in 2020 was like a real experience. It's also an incredibly well-made game. It's one of the reasons why I have a lot of hopes for the Last of Us TV series that Neil Druckmann, who has produced the games, is now making for HBO. But none of that, none of the kind of the spark or wit or character stuff that works so well in the Uncharted games was there. And those games actually do draw you in and make you care about the characters in a way that I would say is, it's not like arty and or, you know, deep in the sense of a modern Oscar winner that nobody has seen, right? No, but it's like Spielbergian. It just really works well in a somewhat surface level, but like in the way that E.T. is of both a very popular film, and like you end up caring a lot about E.T. and these kids, and like it like actually draws you in. And popular art can do that, and should try to do that. And well, this movie didn't even bother.
Of course, it
can.
Of course it can do that. Nobody's saying it can't do that.
And my point is, the games, these freaking video games actually do that. And
I've played them. I've played them. They're fine.
These video games
are
totally
fine.
And
they don't.
This movie
made. They don't.
No, Sonny, that's because you're a heartless.
Caring about Nathan Drake is the biggest waste of time that anybody could. Again, the games are fine. I enjoy the games. I like them. And this movie is fine. Again, borderline base competence is like not to be sneered at in this day and age. But there is nothing that I felt like I was missing out on that it wasn't more than fine.
I think we're going to end up that like where this is going is that we are going to need a best superhero movie or video game adaptation category at the Oscars. That's 5 years from now when the Uncharted reboot comes out and Sonny, you come out from it and you go, that was the greatest piece of popular art I've seen.
The Uncharted
since
reboot starring Adam Driver as Nathan Drake.
There you go. No, as Sully. He's going to be the old guy by then. But
isn't he going to be Nathan Drake's like tortured in prison brother, Sam, or whatever the hell his name is supposed to be?
I mean, they didn't show us his face, so it could
be
anybody.
Who cares about any of this? That's
well,
the problem.
Clearly, the filmmakers didn't.
Nobody cares. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm mostly just interested in this as a film that is, you know, kind of signifying where the state of like the next iteration of like endless IP grabs are coming from. And I do think that video games remain a like largely untapped field. Like, for instance, I mean, as we were right before we started taping this, they announced that Walton Goggins is going to be starring in a Fallout series
for Amazon
Prime Video. Yep. Which will be interesting. I mean, I played 5 minutes in one of the Fallout games, and they're too complicated for
me,
too open.
Fallout 3 and Fallout 4 are probably the two games I've spent the most time with in my life. I mean, hundreds of hours, and I just find them they're incredible games. And I think in some ways, you know, these adaptations are better suited to series just because video games are so long and there's so much material, and even 8 or 10 hours, you know, is just going to work much better than a 2-hour movie. But you talked at the beginning, Sonny, about the surprisingly pretty good box office for Uncharted, the fact that it's the first post-Spider-Man hit. And I think it's pretty clear that it's not because of the stars. It's because of the IP. And it's the same, like, that's why the Marvel movies sell well. And that's why Uncharted is doing well, is because these IPs actually sell movies. And so Uncharted is going to be a test case, I suspect, for a lot more adaptations. I think you're totally right. So we can expect, you know, Grand Theft Auto with The Rock.
Yay.
And then we can take bets on which auteur will, you know, swoop up Tom Holland and, like, you know, Scorsese and Leonardo DiCaprio turn Tom Holland into, you know, our next great leading man.
No. He's charming. He's charming in his own way.
I think he's
poorly cast in this movie because I think that the whole movie is based on a mistake of having young Nathan Drake instead of old Nathan Drake. I mean, like,
in the games, he reads much closer to, say, 35 or 38. And he also seems exactly like Nathan Fillion. He reads like Serenity, Firefly era Nathan Fillion, like almost exactly voice, affect, like he's just got that same vibe. And that was who a lot of people wanted to play him as this movie was in development for many, many years. And I don't think Holland really sells the character.
Well, I also don't think it's fair to put Tom Holland up against Antonio Banderas. There's a real charisma mismatch there. And again, I like Tom Holland. I think he's very good as Spider-Man, but He looks very young. He's a very young looking individual.
Now, granted, that was also a knock against Leonardo DiCaprio, was that even into his 30s, he was still playing boyish parts. And it's only as he has gotten into his, you know, early mid 40s that he has started playing somewhat older looking characters.
Yeah, well, there's still hope for Tom Holland, I guess. He can get older. All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on Uncharted? Alyssa?
Thumbs down.
Peter?
Thumbs down.
Thumbs down for me, mixed thumbs down. Could have been worse. I've seen worse video game movies, but
I give it two thumbsticks down.
It's not a left, it's not a good right. Still not. I give it an L2. I'm going to tap my L2. All right, that is it for today's show. If you loved it, make sure to check out our members-only bonus episode coming Friday to atma.thebulwark.com. On Steven Soderbergh's new film, Kimmy. Make sure to tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If we don't grow, we will die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SonnyBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.